It's the Kiki Music that means it's time once again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I am your thankfully temporary host, Stephen Thompson, filling in for Linda Holmes as she attends the Television Critics Association press tour out in California. This week on Pop Culture Happy Hour, we will talk about the new film Fruitvale Station and the challenges of dramatizing real-world controversies. Then we will return to an old favorite, Tech Holdouts, or as I have come to subtitle it, Yelling at Clouds. And then we will close, as always, with what's making us happy this week. Let's go around the table and introduce this week's reconstituted panel. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I write and tweet about race, ethnicity, and culture for Code Switch.
And Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I also write and tweet about race, ethnicity, and culture for NPR's Code Switch.
So why do we have both of you? If you just do the same thing.
We don't really need Kat.
We're only on here because we fight all the time, and so it's entertaining.
Excellent. So we're bringing you guys in here to squabble. Our absent pal, Trey Graham, is off visiting nephews and making me miss my kids by tweeting about it. Thanks a lot, jerk.
Yeah.
All right. We've reached the point in the summer when movies with fighting robots and leveled cities start to give way to some of the year's major films. So we thought we would start by talking about one that a lot of people are talking about right now, Fruitvale Station, which is obviously received a lot of attention due to some of its similarities in content to the recent Trayvon Martin verdict, but it is itself based on a true story of the shooting of a 22-year-old unarmed man named Oscar Grant in Oakland. And the film is a dramatization of his final day. So we thought we would talk about the movie first and then kind of fan out from there. Gene, what are your thoughts on Fruitvale Station?
So Fruitvale Station, and Kat and I were talking about this before, is a fantastically well-acted movie. It's one of those movies that you're like, wow, this is really impressive. I will never watch it ever again. Right. It is a really, really psychically taxing movie to watch. And, you know, if you didn't see the first minute or so when they open up with the actual now famous videotape of Oscar Grant being shot as he's face down on a BART platform.
Handcuffed face down.
Face down on a subway platform by a police officer. You could mistake the rest of the movie up until the shooting at the end. You could mistake everything that happens between the actual footage they show in the beginning and the dramatized version of the shooting as just like a kind of mumblecore kind of like day in the life of this guy in Oakland.
If you didn't know from the beginning how it's going to end, it would be an interesting slice of life.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it is like having something pressing on your chest.
Yeah, as everything starts to gather tension as the day goes on. Like his mother says, oh, get on the train. You know, it's safer for you to be on the train on the years as opposed to driving. And everything starts to be like, you want him to make a bunch of smaller, like different small decisions.
You want him to live, essentially. Yeah. I remember sitting in the theater and after, there were some people who walked out and they were saying, oh my God, the whole time I thought that he was gonna live.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I guess maybe they missed.
Did they walk in late?
maybe they missed the first 2 minutes or something.
Yeah.
In Grantland, Wesley Morris had a piece about this film, and his first sentence kind of summed it up for me. Sometimes what's wrong with a film suddenly no longer matters. He kind of talks about the film itself and dings it for things for which I think it's kind of dingable for some of its sentimentality, and then goes and talks about the Trayvon Martin case and the reaction to it, which is a lot more insular and inward-focused than a lot of people were expecting, and how this film acts as a sort of catharsis. And I certainly buy that. But my issues with it were simply that, you know, lives don't have narrative arcs. Films do. And when we impose a narrative arc on something, we are naturally falsifying it. And my thing is, I sat there in the theater thinking, I wish this was a documentary, which is a stupid thing to think of because, I mean, like, because documentaries can falsify. Documentaries can obfuscate just as much as a narrative film can. But when I hit the scene with a dog, we don't know to say what
the scene. I wanted to talk about the dog, too. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the lens flare.
Here's the thing that kept coming back to me, which is that, you know, a kid, a young, black, unarmed kid died for no reason. That's facts enough. The facts of the case are harrowing and gut-wrenching. And I don't know what all this extra stuff, what it was doing for me was raising questions that have no business being asked. Like, did this dog thing really happen?
Right.
Did he really do this thing with the bag of pot that he does in this film?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't matter if he was turning his life around or not. What matters is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I would much rather spend time on seeing what happened and then the aftermath of it, because the aftermath is outrageous in its way. And that's the stuff that seeing how the legal system failed or you know, whatever your point of view is, but seeing how the legal system worked this kid through the system and the officer responsible through the system, that was far more interesting to me than what I felt was the choices they were making were choices that you make when you're making a narrative film, telling a story. And those choices didn't belong here because you're exposing the artifice of storytelling. You're exposing the artifice of filmmaking in a way that just felt, I shouldn't be sitting here having these questions because these questions don't matter because the kid is dead.
Right. There are all these moments that are just really neat, right? The way the event that becomes the catalyst for Oscar Grant's handcuffing in the first place.
Oscar from Pharmacia?
Right.
Did he know the guy? I mean, it was like, the guy he has the conversation with, you know, the movie kind of suggests that they knew each other from prison, and it's like...
Yeah, there's little of that backstory. That is a, especially in about an 80-minute film,
right,
a missing component in it. And I think that's a choice that the director, Ryan Coogler, first-time filmmaker.
Yeah, right.
And I think outstanding first-time filmmaker. But I'll get to my rebuttal of what Glenn's saying, but I wanted to get Kat's thoughts in here.
Yeah, I mean, what Glenn was saying about how... I would almost say, like, the romanticizing of this story, creating these characters, like that woman Oscar Grant meets in the grocery store who later calls his name on the subway. And, like, I kept wondering, does she exist? But what was happening was those subplots were just very distracting from what actually happened. You have this 22-year-old man who was shot unarmed after New Year's, and it doesn't matter if he was trying to turn his life around, if he was trying to make a better life for him and his children and his family, or his one daughter, that is.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, he's dead. And I think the last few minutes of the film where Ryan Coogler pulls back from the film and he shows the aftermath and how on New Year's Day for the following years, people kind of rally at that station at Fruitvale, you see that it's still affecting people. And you lose that sense sometimes from the movie, and so I agree with what you say completely.
Mm. Okay, I'm going to defend this movie.
I did, go for it.
I really admired the decision that was made, and that the decision was clearly made very early, that what they wanted to do was not make a story about the failings of the legal system. I think that story played out in the media. I think the decision that Coogler made was, I want to show the life that was lost, the flawed, uneven, unvarnished. You have elements of this guy's life where he is not somebody who has never made bad decisions. He is not somebody who is without faults. He makes bad decisions in his relationship.
Are you gonna say bye?
Bye.
Love you too.
He's selling weed. There's not an effort to airbrush a halo over him. And I think that the decision that's made there is to just show the life and to put you in the life and take you out of the idea of this is a person who, you know, this is a person who's dead. Well, people die all the time. Mm-hmm. And you almost get like, well, here's this guy. I don't know this guy. I definitely think there's an element of this movie that I think is being made for white audiences.
Hmm. Sure.
That is trying to take people into a world that they themselves don't inhabit. So they understand this is a life like any life. And I think that leaving out the legal proceedings, leaving out, frankly, the perspective of the shooter.
Right.
There's a brief mention of the shooter's defense, just as they're wrapping a bow on the movie. But it's not necessarily a crime story.
Okay. Well, let me say that I don't tend to like films that are based on actual events, based on a true story, for exactly the reasons I kind of touched on that are endemic to this idea of when you are turning actual events into a story. There is a question of, this is going to sound like a semantic difference, and I don't mean it to be one, but films that this is getting compared to are like Boys in the Hood, Do the Right Thing, and it's also being compared,
much less stylish than those.
And it's less polemic than those movies.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And The Wire, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Now, those films have a reality. They're realistic, which we have some wiggle room in the world realism because there's an ism there. It's like real mystic. But it has an internal consistency. It's completely fictional, but, you know, you can pick up some analogs. Here, there are questions of authenticity which enter into it. Realism versus authenticity. These moments, because they feel like dramatic tropes, the question that the daughter asks him about, you know, I don't want you to go out, Daddy, because there's fireworks and they sound like guns.
You know, baby, those are just firecrackers.
You're safe inside with your cousins.
What about you, Daddy?
Me? Maybe I'm gonna be fine.
All those moments are just causing me to spend time thinking inessential questions when there's a giant question hanging over this film that's much more important than the... This could just be my Vulcan, you know, anti-emotion.
I don't understand why we are learning about this person's feelings.
Exactly. But I mean, all those moments felt... I don't want to say they felt cheap and false, because, I mean, this was some good filmmaking, and I totally get it. But I just was not... Again, we've talked about this in the past. I'm not concerned with the things the filmmakers are concerned about. And I feel this force of artifice that I just wish wasn't part of my thought process.
So to Steven's point about not showing the perspective of the shooter, I thought that was actually really affecting when the shooting actually happens on the platform. And you can see the cop is panicked. Like, he doesn't know what's going on. And you only see enough of it to know that this situation has gotten completely out of control. And we don't know, again, like, that's, I guess, the central mystery of and tragedy of the story is that it was avoidable, and we don't know why the shooting happened in the first place. And there was a moment of, like, even that brief glimpse that we get of the cop, that he was kind of a human being, right? That even though the cops were clearly antagonizing these kids.
Right. You saw a certain amount of confusion in the shooter's eyes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and Stephen, to your point before when you were talking about how the story is about relationships, I know that, like, that is exactly what Ryan Coogler was getting at, because I think he was telling someone, and I think it might have been an NPR reporter, that he wanted to tell the story of the people who knew Oscar Grant best, and you really get that narrative. And whether or not it is, like, what I personally wanted as a viewer, I think it does show, like, how real it could have been. In a sense. But yeah.
I mean, to Glenn's point again, though, I absolutely agree with him about, I think biopics are like the lowest form of of popular movie. I think they're terrible. I think they're always boring. I think they're always predictable. They're really formulaic. And this, you know, I think movies that do work well, that are based on true events, are always based on a part of someone's life, like a moment. Right.
Good point.
And not like, you know, the entire trajectory of their existence.
Yeah.
I think one advantage that this film has over other biopics is we don't know Oscar Grant.
Mm-hmm.
We know his face from posters, and even some of those are drawings of his face. We don't necessarily know who he is as a person. So I can't believe we've gotten this far in the conversation without talking about Michael B. Jordan, the actor who plays Oscar Grant, who is absolutely superb in this film. We were just talking about Orange is the New Black in a recent episode, and talking about acting with one's eyes.
Right.
And there's so much acting with his eyes that goes on, and these very quick shifts that, I mean, we talk about code switching. Mm-hmm. The amount of code switching that he does during the course of this movie, of how he interacts with his mother, how he interacts at the store, how he interacts with his friends,
absolutely,
how he interacts with his girlfriend, how he interacts with his daughter.
Hey, what's that, girl?
And there's such subtle acting along the way, and I don't want to lose the point that Michael B. Jordan, who's been on The Wire,
Friday Night Lights.
I mean, he is a superb actor. It is a superb performance. I'm sure we will be talking about it again in awkward conversations about how to talk about the Academy Awards without talking about Oscar. And I just hope Billy Crystal doesn't host the Oscars and do some sort of, like, dress as Octavia Spencer and talk about standing up for Oscar.
Oh, boy.
Please.
I'm dreading it in advance.
No, he was absolutely fantastic in this movie. And he has, you know, Linda Holmes will tell you how charismatic he is. I guess he kissed her on the cheek once.
Oh, yeah, and she completely swooned.
That was a seminal moment for her, I suppose. but, you know, you get glimpses of it on Friday Night Lights. I don't know if you guys watched that show.
Sure.
Did you ever watch it, Steve?
You know, I'm still very slowly working my way through it from the beginning. I've loved what I've seen, but I'm super, super early.
Yeah, I haven't seen The Wire or Friday Night Lights. So this was the first time I've actually...
But Gene actually just clutched his pearls. I didn't know Gene wore pearls.
Yeah.
He pulled them out just for now.
It was more his heart, Steve. Pearls are up here.
Oh, the pearls can hang lower.
Okay. They're lower. They're it's like a Jesus piece more. Like.
Anyway, Kat, you have not seen The Wire or Friday Night.
Yeah, so this was my first time seeing Michael B. Jordan in action, and I was really amazed. And then I heard Linda tell that story about how she met him, and I was like, wow.
I mean, he's on The Wire. He's, you know, he's, I don't know, I guess he's 15 maybe in the show.
He's very young.
He's really young. And so, you know, he plays Wallace, who's this kind of naive, he's just a kid, right? He plays a kid who happens to be a drug dealer. So he's naive and he's, you know.
And he's young, he's 15.
Right. And so the world is, you know, starting to weigh on him. I won't ruin what happens.
Yeah, please don't.
But on Friday Night Lights, he's this charismatic, hot-headed, hotshot quarterback of this troubled inner city football team, and that was the first time I thought, I was like, oh, this kid's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But I didn't realize that he had this in him. I didn't realize he had Fruitvale Station in him. He's really good in this movie.
It is a superb performance, and there are a lot of superb performances in this film, but he is very much at the heart of it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about some other, you know, I think Glenn, you were the one I believe who mentioned Do the Right Thing and Boys in the Hood, and I wanted to talk a little bit about other films that are touching, I mean, not biopics so much as, in a way, almost inadvertent movie of the week type things. Movies that wind up touching on current events in powerful ways. And you know, I was trying to think of some examples, and I kept stumbling more into more historical civil rights films like Four Little Girls or
Mississippi Burning.
Yeah, or Mississippi Burning. Or
you know, Malcolm X or something like that.
Or which is more your conventional biopic.
Right.
But how this film has wound up being, you know, extremely relevant, but also, you know, how it taps into a current conversation.
Yeah, so much of Kat and I were just talking about this, about, you know, the movie premiered to wide release the same week, I think, of the Zimmerman
verdict. Yeah.
So the conversation about, you know, black men being deemed suspicious was like something that, just in talking about the movie, it's almost, when I talk about it with my friends, we talk about it and all the stuff around it, right? We talk about stop and frisk, and we talk about all these other things that are happening kind of circling around the issues in this
movie. Anything related to racial profiling.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and it's hard to kind of remove that linkage between, you know, the news event of Trayvon Martin and Fruitvale when it comes out.
When you're talking ripped from the headlines, this is nothing like any of this stuff, but Law and Order, okay? Law and Order constantly rips something from the headline and then takes it. So the first 5 minutes would be something you just saw in the news like a month before, and then it just turns it into this whole banana pants weird direction. That's what they do every time. So pretty soon you're just watching to make, like you watch every other episode of Law and Order, you're waiting for the character actor that you know because that's what it did.
Why else somebody, is he or she there?
Exactly. Yeah. If somebody was interviewed for 2 minutes and then go on, that's the one who did it. If it's James Urbaniak, you know he's coming back. But there is, in that kind, especially for television, there is something that feels lurid, salacious, opportunistic about this whole, it's called ripped from the headlines because it's done quickly.
Right, exactly. Man, they managed to turn that around awfully quickly.
Yeah, that's the thing you keep thinking about. Also, when you go into a bookstore, when you used to go into bookstores, and you'd see like something based on an event in the news that just comes out in that really cheap pulp paper because it was literally just printed and distributed to stores within a week. I mean, that's kind of the thing I was thinking of. But as far as, ripped from the headlines, are we talking about like contemporary things? As we go back to Mississippi Burning, that's not really the same thing. That's something that has had a lot of scholarship behind it, had a lot of thought and time to.
Yeah, I guess one thing that I was thinking is sometimes you have, you know, this movie certainly has gained a lot of attention in part because of the timing associated with the Zimmerman verdict, but also you have art that accidentally bumps up against controversial issues. The fact that when the original Trayvon Martin shooting happened, there was a movie coming out called Neighborhood Watch.
Right.
And that was like a wacky comedy. Like,
was
these
it
guys,
like, oh, really?
It, like bumbling neighborhood watch people. And was it Craig James
nothing,
in it?
Nothing racial about it at all?
I mean, I haven't seen the film.
I think it was about aliens. I think they were protecting the world from aliens. I think, was it Ben Stiller?
Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, I remember.
And they had to change the name of the film to The Watch.
The Watch. Right.
Mm-hmm. In part to separate it. I mean, it really didn't have anything to do with the case. But, you know, there was an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer that had coincided, it was about to air when Columbine happened.
Right.
And the episode was all about somebody is potentially going to open fire in a school. And it's eerie how similar it was in many ways thematically to Columbine. And they ended up pulling it and delaying it for months and months because it was so close.
Mm-hmm.
But this film, it's interesting how it's, you know, there's obviously no attempt to distance this film from the Trayvon Martin case.
Now, what do you guys think of this notion of catharsis? This came up in the Wesley Morris piece, as I mentioned. Stephen, did you see it in the theater or did you see a screener?
I actually watched it on an online screener,
okay,
which, you know, is a somewhat different experience. It allowed me to go back and immediately watch the first minute again.
Sure.
And to sort of recast that scene having seen the movie, which that was useful, but otherwise it does minimize.
Because I saw it in a theater, which means I am better than you.
Right. Sure. No, absolutely.
But it is a fundamentally different experience because it was a mixed crowd, racially mixed, age mixed crowd. And, you know, little things like the moment when we find out what happened to the shooter, like what his fate was.
Oh, yeah.
Gasps.
Yeah, gasps.
Gasps of disbelief in the crowd. And also, when the lights come back up, it is just the most... I can't remember being in a theater and just having... feeling this oppressive silence of just everybody being alone with their thoughts in a very clear way. That cloud didn't break until a block, two blocks away from the theater. It was amazing.
Wow, I believe that.
I'm not something I want to experience again.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It was a really powerful movie that you will, again, not revisit. Right. And I wonder about, like... its value as a film because of that, right? I mean, like, if it's something you will never, ever touch again, like, it's like, okay, let's put it up on the mantle.
But then at the same time, I think it's one of those films where people are saying, you have to see this film if you want to kind of be in the conversation of what's going on now. And so I think that even in 5 years or 10 years, people will still refer to it that way.
Sure. And it's not alone in that regard. Yeah. Every year at Oscar time, we're talking about a movie like Amour. Right. And I can't imagine sitting down. I loved Amour, but I can't imagine sitting down and watching it again. And I mean, the experience that I felt through the whole thing, the emotions that I felt through the whole thing was sad, 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 angry. Mm.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And, right. And then sad again.
And then sad again. And that's a tough thing to be brought through, but it's also, I think, a sense that it's a powerfully made film.
Right, and also that gets to what we're talking about catharsis. I mean, there is a sense that you watch this film to work out these emotions of incredible frustration you feel about the verdict, about a different verdict. This sense of not being able to get your head around things, not being able to do anything about it. Having this movie push your buttons and make you there are people around me crying and people seething. You could feel them silently seething when the film, you know, finally ended up. That has a purpose, that has a reason for being. It gives the film a purpose. What do you guys think of that? Did you guys feel that?
No, I totally agree, and I think that's why Coogler probably wanted to make it as raw as possible, you know, get the family story in there, and just so there would sort of be this intention to have people do something after, like, to bring back or circle back to my point where at the ending credits or right before it ended, he showed footage of, like, people going back to Fruitvale Station on the anniversaries. I think it was kind of to say, no, this is still an issue that's going on now. Here is the daughter in the movie, and here she is in real life, and she actually looks almost uncannily the same, which is what Gene and I were kind of freaked out about. And I think you're like, oh my God, what is this family doing now? Because they're clearly still struggling with this issue.
Yeah, I think when the Oscar Grant shooting first happened, my friend was in town from Puerto Rico, and I showed her the video of the shooting, and it just started being viral. And I remember she was in my house and she started crying. I remember talking to my friend and saying, like, this will end in some kind of acquittal, or this will end in a way that will not satisfy
anyone. This is not going to satisfy people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember watching, when I watched, I didn't cry when I saw the original video, when the videos first became public, when they were first on YouTube. But I remember crying in the movie theater when I saw this movie. And I was just amazed that this, you know, this thing is approaching, or is going for verisimilitude, was the thing that was more affecting to me than the actual video itself.
I mean, I hope we can all agree it's a good movie.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, that you know, we may argue about the some of the decisions that the director made. I think it's an important film,
and
well worth seeing. All right, so we'd love to have you come and join us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH to discuss your thoughts on Fruitvale Station and other films of that nature. So, speaking of the internet, if we may use the smoothest segue ever, we wanted to talk a little bit about a topic we've discussed on the show before, tech holdouts, and talking about technologies that we have ourselves not yet embraced with a little bit on why. For example, I had said in a previous segment, I don't have a DVR. For example, I still use a VHS tape recorder if I want to tape something and watch it later. I know it's been. I mean, I'll often stream things on the internet.
Can you buy VHS? Where do you go to buy VHS?
I have a.
So vintage of you.
It's like I admitted that I just yell out of windows instead of using the telephone.
Yeah.
But you know, I think we all have technologies that we embrace or are slow to pick up.
Can we talk about the logistics of this though? well, your VHS thing.
Oh, yeah. Does this make your life very hard? And do your kids
nobody
get frustrated?
Nobody knows.
Do you make jokes about like how hard it is to program your VCR? And people are like, what is a VCR? What is
that? All right, it's still flashing 12 o'clock. And people are like, what? Is that a thing? I mean, I have like a big tub of VHS tapes that I reuse. It's mostly, I don't know.
It's mostly The Bachelor, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, snap. Yeah, that's a sad example, but I thought we would use sort of a fresh round. I'm going to start with Glenn. Hit me with the tech holdout.
Well, I mean, I still maintain my antipathy toward Facebook. Don't use it. I don't care for it. I mean, it seems to me that there used to be jokes about how you'd go over to somebody's house and watch their vacation slides and how boring that was. And that's what Facebook is. Plus rants. That seems to me, mm-hmm. and also people from high school, I don't want to know. Mm-hmm.
Except you don't have to attend the slide presentation. You can actually literally sleep through it as if it doesn't
exist. Or hide their feed.
So every time there's a fresh round of people griping about Facebook and how they changed their privacy settings and blah, 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 I just get even more smug, which is saying something.
Yeah, wow.
Which is, I know.
You don't even break when that happens.
But and in lieu of Facebook, I just love Twitter. I've talked about this before, but it's, you know, my writing style is a little verbose, mm-hmm. and it tends to go on. If you read the Comic-Con diaries, they do go on. So this is a writing exercise to me. Can I do a joke in 140 characters? Can I get in and out? That's great. Now, the thing about it is, it's kind of the same thing you guys are talking about with Facebook. There is a world of Twitter that I just never get into because the people I follow are people who tell funny jokes. I don't ever hit the trending topic because as soon as I do, it's a whole weird area. It's like this no man's land where there are no vowels and nothing but emojis.
And no spaces.
Here there be dragons, but no punctuation.
And pictures of food and workout
regimens. Everything's
regiments.
All caps. Yeah.
Workout regimens, Jane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Oh, yeah. Gina's all about that. Oh.
Yeah.
If you ever want to feel bad about yourself, just go to Gene's Twitter feed.
Is that something that the program does, or do you actually sit there typing in, did 26?
I ran 18 miles on Runkeeper, and I'm like reading your Twitter feed in bed in my underwear with my laptop on my stomach.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's also like 100 degrees out.
Yeah, yeah. Right? These are all things.
Anyway, these are all things we didn't want to know.
This is actually why I hate Gene.
That's why? I did do some shoe leather reporting. I asked my niece what she's into, and she said she's off of Facebook. She hasn't updated her Facebook page in months. She is using Twitter. Now, that surprised me because I figured Twitter was all about 30-somethings and 40-somethings. That's kind of where, historically, that's kind of where
look at the trending, look at the hashtag trending topics.
I know.
Think if it's all comedy writers.
But it's texting and Twitter. Is where she is, the youth of today, with their rock and roll music and their rumble seats.
I've heard someone else say the same thing, that they'd migrated from Facebook to Twitter and to Instagram, that those were the places that they were.
Right, Instagram, that's also a thing.
And everybody just forget about Tumblr. But, there's Snapchat.
Yeah, talk about Snapchat. I don't understand it.
Glenn and I are both curious as to what the hell the deal is with Snapchat. I think selfie porn. But tell us what.
Okay, so Snapchat, I think it originated as weird selfie porn, you know, and you would snap this photo of yourself.
Is it a photo or a video?
It's a photo. It can be a photo or a video for up to however many seconds, I think maybe up to 10. I don't know. Clearly, I don't use the video option that much.
Right.
And it's since evolved into a way that people communicate, and you can add text to it.
But the message self-destructs.
The key. It goes away after 9 seconds, and you...
In 9 seconds
or so, like you can. You
but you, I'm totally messing you watch with it. Them. You watch it, but you can't rewatch it.
Yeah.
It's
so it's, why, if you're not doing dirty things, why? What is
yeah,
it
what
for?
No,
the
so,
non-dirty.
So what
purpose.
I was trying to get at before is, I think it's evolved from really dirty ways of communicating, as in like selfie porn, as Stephen said, to actually communicating with your friends. So I have some friends who will only communicate with me via Snapchat, and I'm sort of like, wait.
They sound like terrible people.
Are we boiling down our texting friendship? You know, because I have friends who live in Seattle.
Words are hard.
who live in Chicago, and it's you know, sometimes it's hard.
Why
to
wouldn't you just text and then?
Yeah, exactly. But so I'm getting these inanimate object photos, like a snap of someone's food or a snap of someone's shoe.
But if you ever want to see that
walking,
if you ever want to see that lobster roll again, it's gone.
I know, right? No, but you can take a screenshot of the photo.
Well, and that's the other thing. That's the other thing. I'm assuming there have to be workarounds, nefarious ways to snatch a permanent copy of the thing that is supposed to self-destruct.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Thus eliminating the only thing it can possibly be for.
But if I were to take a screenshot of a snap that somebody sent me, it would alert them right away. But my point is, the reason why Snapchat is so bothersome to me is because it's just, you know, another way that communication between people has just become so much shallower. Like, I really don't need to see this cupcake that you're sending me, or I don't need to see this cat. There's Instagram, there's, like, Facebook for these things.
But isn't there a certain sort of tyranny about that, a passive-aggressive tyranny where you're, like, saying, you need to pay attention to this now. I'm sending this to you now, and you must pay attention to it now or else it's going to be gone? Seems even more...
I would assume you click on it. It sits there until you click on it.
Yeah, it sits there until you click on it. And then once you start holding it down to view it for the allotted time, like 9 seconds, 10 seconds, then you have to continue pressing your finger down to see it. Otherwise, it'll just go away and you can completely miss a photo or a video.
But I just asked dad question.
I'm also just picturing, I'm picturing these layers and layers of gadgets because I'm picturing somebody holding a camera phone to another camera phone to capture a permanent version of the thing that will
disappear. You can just take a screenshot, Stephen.
But it alerts. I don't know.
You could just plug your VCR into it.
Did I just get Snapchat? Yeah. all right, but in that similar vein, I guess where I become old man yells at cloud. First of all, I don't use the cloud. But second of all is the proliferation of the thing that you communicate with gives you 6 seconds. There I'm talking, of course, about Vine. And I was recently asked as part of the NPR Generation Listen project to record a Vine asking a question of the TED Radio Hour host, Guy Raz.
Mm-hmm. So you host a popular NPR program. Do you think you're better than me?
So there was this whole process of, can you do this, ask something funny? You know, first of all, anytime you are brought in and asked to say something funny, forget it. Hey, bring in your hilarious comedy jokes. And so I have a notepad, and I scribble down all of these different, you know, goofy questions that I could ask Guy Raz. And each one, in the time it takes me to set up a joke, basically, Daisy, the woman who was holding up the phone and recording my Vine, is kind of doing a little count with her hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And basically what I've gotten out by the time the 6 seconds have passed is So I had to crush these sort of Twitter-length musings into what you heard there, which was, 12 words?
So you host a popular NPR program. Do you think you're better than me?
And that's it. And so there's no way to me to use it to set up more than an idea. And there's no pacing to it. And now Guy Raz recorded a response also via Vine.
I don't think I'm better than you, but my mom does.
So where they splice in, and I don't know how this stuff, I'm assuming it involves magnets. They splice in, a guy is sitting at my desk eating my sunflower seeds as he's saying this, but they splice in video for the last, 2 seconds of his mother looking at him adoringly. Now, I had wanted to set up a Vine-based Twitter beef between Guy Raz's mom and my mom, in which I was trying to goad my mom into viciously attacking Guy Raz's mom and trying to build that up into something.
By the way, Vine-based Twitter beef is what I realized that the society must crumble now. It's over.
I had to pause and think about that.
It's
Vine-based
done.
Vine-based Twitter beef.
Well, and my mother tweets back like, what the hell is a Vine-based Twitter beef?
Wait, your mom is on Twitter?
Oh yeah.
My mom has been a guest panelist on this show.
Yeah,
sure. No way.
You can follow her on Twitter at Thompson Maggie.
Yes, you can.
And she's a genius.
So I don't understand Vine either, especially its repetitious quality. It's like it's automatically looping. there are people who do it well. There is James Urbaniak, the actor I mentioned earlier, creates little teeny tiny movies. And the key to this is that there has to be a very rough, slapped together lo-fi quality to it, because as soon as somebody tries to invest too much time and setup into it, the whole appeal of it, which is to be ephemeral and sort of vanish and not be thought about very, very much once it's done, goes away. But he's really good at it. I haven't found too many other people who are. What do you guys think?
There was this one Vine that I thought was fascinating. It was like how to whatever, right? And it was always just like how to make eggs, whatever, and it would be someone.
And so in 6 seconds.
Well, he would have an egg carton, and then he would open the egg carton, and then he would take like a sledgehammer to it, and it was like, what? And it was hilarious because it was just so ridiculous, sure. And there was a whole bunch of stuff like that. I don't know that makes me want to ever revisit Vine, like, you know, it's like ha ha ha. I'm never opening this app ever again.
Right.
Gene, what else you got? What else are you resisting?
Tumblr. I mean, she mentioned Tumblr. I hate Tumblr. I don't actually have any kind of evolved thoughts on it. Like, this is why I hate Tumblr. It makes me angry. People are like, what am I?
I don't know why, but it makes me angry.
I would like to briefly address my free-floating hatred.
It's not really tethered to anything, really.
What about it?
It seems like I was a blogger before I got here.
You're still a blogger.
Yeah. So, well.
Kind of stuff.
I was a real blogger before I sold out. Like, Tumblr just seems like
you sold out. It's just a big
says the lead blogger
to big public radio
to big donor. I like the medium of blogs. Like I like, you know, people's kind of discursive and not sometimes reported thoughts on things. And I feel like Tumblr kind of condensed everything to like
it makes it too snappy.
Yeah,
too,
it's just like
too brief.
Here's the pull quote.
It's really great for photos. I mean,
yeah. And Glenn is on Tumblr.
Yeah, I'm using it as a sort of visual companion to the book because I couldn't afford to put pictures in the book because I would take away my little tiny advance. So I'm using it because the internet is a lawless frontier and I can pull things from all over the place. I can put it up on there and then link to longer pieces. So I mean, it fulfills a very specific need for me, and I do follow certain people on Tumblr. Who it's a mixture of funny image, maybe a little pithy little thing underneath it, but that's kind of it. Instagram, I don't get at all.
Mm-hmm. I am not on Instagram and have not even figured out how to use it, which is, again, it's kind of the equivalent of the VCR. Like, I actually don't know
how
to
your Instagram
sign up
is
for the app. And think about how many thundering idiots are on Instagram.
Steven's Instagram is him taping Polaroids to a wall and then looking at them and adding a heart if he likes it. Aww. And people will go up and hurt it.
No, he'll put like his sunglasses on. Like, that's
yeah,
a filter.
Yeah.
There you go. Yes. I'm an analog man.
But to Tumblr, you know, Google recently killed Reader, which was the way I used to share, like whenever I was finding random stuff like that was coming across my friend's field of vision or whether I wanted to share something. That was how I got it. And I guess I'm just feeling kind of curmudgeonly about it because I thought a Reader, before they kind of started pulling away all the features, was this like incredibly effective way to have conversations about like not completely formed idea. Like someone's like, hey, did you read this article? And then all of your friends who were not your Facebook friends, because your Facebook friends, like you said, are all bigots and homophobes from high school, who you don't want to have these conversations with, but people who are like thoughtful about things. And you could just kind of flesh things out before you took them out into the world to share them.
I think with just about any social medium, Glenn touched on this with Twitter, that if you find a pod within that service or app or site or whatever, you can have a good experience. I just find in general that and again, it's old man yelling at cloud, there are so many to choose from that every time one is added, it's like, oh, I got to get a Vine now. Yeah. I got to do Tumblr. I got to do Instagram. I mean, like, I've got a Facebook page and I've got Twitter. I mean, I'm theoretically on Google+, though I don't know what it entails.
No, everyone is theoretically on Google+. Yeah. It is a vast wasteland.
Sometimes I'll get notifications and I'll say, I have no idea what this is.
Yeah. Who cares?
Most of the people who add me on Google+ are people I have never heard of.
It's well, do you guys have different, we talk about this sometimes, like, what is the different calculus you use to decide whether you want to follow someone or friend someone?
Oh yeah, or you accept somebody's LinkedIn request, or
yeah, like,
you know,
LinkedIn
is this whole other.
Yeah, LinkedIn is a whole other animal of, unless I'm looking for a job, LinkedIn I will accept anyone who is related to the music business, but if it's somebody I don't know and it's like acupuncturist, then I don't. Mm-hmm. Facebook, I have to know who they are. There are pictures of my kids on there. I tend to keep that somewhat more of a closed circle. Obviously, spam bots, porn bots follow me on Twitter, pumps up my number. Well, if you have been a late adopter, a non-adopter, an early adopter, or want to tease me about my VCR, you may use one of the many social media platforms out there, facebook.com/PCHH. Please like us. It is... We need validation. I guess that's it. Just that number. We just look at a number, and that is the number that says how good we are. So that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? I'm going to start with Kat Chow.
Yes. So the other day, I was talking with a friend, and he just sent me this link to the most hilarious video I've seen in a really long time. It's a year old, but here it is.
Hey, sorry, Mr. Call. I was calling you back to let you know that I love you and I miss you.
Okay, and so I should have given you context before, is the mistake I'm realizing now.
I really want you to call me back.
Oh, it's still going. But anyway, it's called Whale Voicemail. And so what this is it's a voice message that some girl left on someone else's phone. And in the actual YouTube video, there are photos of whales over the girl moaning.
I love you, and I miss you.
And I can't tell because I've been laughing, but I think this has been looping. I'm not sure. But so as soon as I think I was having a really crummy day last week, there was just something really funny about that because, I mean, I have friends.
How about other people's misery?
No, because voicemails are probably the worst thing ever that you can receive.
Nope,
like when someone leaves me a voicemail and I just see it on my phone, luckily I have visual voicemail, I'm like, I'm not going to listen to this. If they, it's really important. They can just call me again until I pick up, or they'll text me and be like, hey, so the cat's dead or something like that. That would actually
so you don't, you guys don't understand.
There's an app. There's actually an app for that.
You don't work with Cat every day, but Cat makes everything about death. So this is the joke
on
our team.
There's
always morbidity.
But anyway, moving on. But voicemail.
We're moving on. Dead cat.
This was the funniest thing because, I mean, I would love to just turn one of my awful voicemails that I get or that I even give into something like that.
So whale mail?
So it's called Whale Voicemail, and it's from a year ago. So I'm really late to this, but it's so hilarious.
Well, we will throw up a link to it on the blog. Whale Voicemail. Thank you, Kat Chow. Gene Demby.
I'm going to sound name drop here. My good friend Wyatt Sinek.
My friend Wyatt.
Once Gene referred to him as my boy Wyatt. So boy. We always make fun of
him. He's an Eagles fan. We watch football together. It's so whatever. And he, this is a story I never heard. Like, all the time I've ever hung out with him, he's never told me this story. He filmed a pilot with Kanye West for an unaired HBO sitcom that was supposed to be like Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm.
With Kanye West.
It was Kanye West.
Renowned for having a sense of humor.
Absolutely. And so apparently this is like top secret or whatever. HBO kind of like had it under wraps for a long time. And so Wyatt has a weekly show in Brooklyn every Monday. And he showed the pilot. I guess he like surreptitiously got his hands on the pilot and showed it to everyone. I wasn't there, but I heard about it, which is crazy in and of itself. And I guess like him and Questlove were like watching this pilot. And I guess HBO asked for a half an hour pilot. And of course, Kanye West was like, I'm going to give you an hour worth of, hour worth of stuff.
My musings.
Exactly. And so apparently Kanye, because he's Kanye and he's crazy, like, you know, he like went to Upright Citizens Brigade and like learned how to do improv.
Or,
well, he like, you know, because he's like.
Studied him.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. Studied. He was in a room with improv comedians.
Yes,
right?
There
And apparently it was kind of a mess.
Really? You don't say.
To no one's surprise. I think we have a clip of it.
I actually haven't been on the cover of Vibes. I was on Time, Rolling Stone, Time.
Time magazine.
You never heard of it, Time?
Oh no, yeah, I've heard of it. I have a subscription. I didn't think they'd put you on the cover. What was for?
No. I mean, well, you didn't have to think they put me on the cover because they did. It didn't have to be in your thoughts. It was in your reality.
That's awesome. Congratulations. What was it for?
It was for being the smartest man in pop music. That's what it said.
It's funny because, you know, if it's just Kanye bragging about himself, that's what he does every day anyway.
Right,
like,
right.
I'm the smartest man in pop music. That's not improvising. but it's just, I guess I have the weirdest, like, I'm sure a lot of people do, have a very weird relationship with Kanye West. Like,
sure.
He is an exasperating person.
Yes.
Right? On one hand, you're
Yeezus,
like...
Yeezus is a in some ways punishing experience.
It is infuriating. Like, yeah. I wanted to, like, crack my laptop over my knee when I heard it. It was just so... It's so indulgent. He is so indulgent. It's just one of the reasons some of my friends love him, but I find him, like, so kind of off-putting. But it's just funny to me that... He would be like, "Oh, Kanye West! Like, I make clothes.
I'm a hilarious comedy joke.
I'm in the sitcom.
Next, mechanical engineering.
I would not get on that plane. But yeah, I wish this thing had existed, like as an actual fully formed mess, so we could have seen it for you know a season or so.
Nice, Glenn Weldon. What do you got?
Kumail Nanjiani is a comedian I've talked about on the show before, a very funny comedian. He plays Pindar on Franklin and Bash, but don't hold that against the poor guy. Guy's going to make some money somewhere. He also has been on Portlandia. He's a very funny small part in a movie called Hell Baby, but he's known as a very good comedian. His first comedy album came out this week. It's called Beta Male, M-A-L-E, and here's a clip.
Most birthdays in Pakistan, a monkey shows up. All right. The fact that you just accepted that is racist. But it also does happen. But the fact that it made sense to you, the fact that you guys were like, oh yeah, in Pakistan, they have monkeys at their birthdays. That's how they do things. Racist. You guys are accurate racists.
So he's great. So this album, there's a Comedy Central special also called Beta Male, but it doesn't have all the bits that are on the album. So a lot of the bits he's had for a long time are on this album, the full album, including a bit, he does a great bit about this drug called cheese.
Yeah, that bit is hilarious.
It's really, really good.
It's really funny.
A bit about riding the Coney Island roller coaster and a bit about getting attacked, basically harangued in Orange County. All very funny, all really smart. Kumail Nanjiani, Nanjiani, and the album's called Beta Male, M-A-L-E.
Nice. Well, I've got a little bit of a smattering. First of all, I do want to acknowledge that this is... Pop Culture Happy Hour's 150th episode.
Sesquicentennial.
Sesquicentennial. Right. I had wanted to talk about famous sesquicentennials, and we just ended up going with Fruitvale instead.
Good for
you. But the full complement of thank yous to everyone involved in the show and everyone who listens, because it is a lovely milestone every time we reach something divisible by 50. I also have a sort of a sad one and a happy one, but they're both recommendations. A lot of people listening to this know by now that NPR's Scott Simon has been, in effect, live-tweeting his mother's death, which sounds like it would not necessarily... When you read it, it is unbelievably graceful and poignant.
And it is not exploitative at all. It is very gentle. It's very... moving.
It's unbelievable. Like, what comes out of it, and I drove back, I'm very, very recently back from the Newport Folk Festival, which I'll talk about in a moment, but at 5 a.m. at a rest stop in Connecticut, I sat with my iPhone in a parking lot scrolling Scott Simon's Twitter feed and crying. Oh, and wow. And it's very powerful. The word I kept coming back to is graceful writing. Mm-hmm. And of course you expect that from Scott. I mean, that's Scott's persona, is he's graceful and smart and charming, but it's beautiful, and it is this lovely chronicling of the end of this woman's life that captures the sort of person she was and the sort of person that he is because of her, and it's beautiful. If you're not following at NPR Scott Simon, you can go back and scroll through the whole thing. It's wrenching and sad and beautiful
and graceful. Exactly.
Graceful, exactly. And the happy thing is I just got back from the Newport Folk Festival, which up in Newport, Rhode Island, which this was my fifth year going, and had an absolutely lovely time. you know, seeing an assortment of bands I already loved, like the Avett Brothers, but also picking up a couple of, discoveries along the way, or bands that I knew I liked but hadn't fully been absorbed by. And two recommendations of artists that people should check out: a woman who goes by the name Cold Specs. She just got nominated for the Polaris Prize, which is the big Canada prize. I don't know. The Morissette Award.
The Coulier Prize.
The Coulier Prize. She put out an album last year called I Predict a Graceful Expulsion, which kind of has electronic overtones to it, but it is her beautiful kind of gospel and soul-informed voice with these haunting guitar lines. And she just walked out, her and an electric guitar, with very few people having heard her, and was a real knockout. We have on the website, and I'll throw up a link, you can download what I think is her best song called Blank Maps. Actually, let's hear a little bit of it right now.
I am a goddamn believer. I am a goddamn believer. With my words head for the clouds, we have my back. We were good children, darling, let it out.
So that's Cold Specs, and also a band we've covered quite a bit on NPR Music, but it's still a very new band called The Lone Bellow, which is not the greatest name, but people who love the Lumineers, Mumford & Sons, Bowler Hat and Suspenders bands, which I'm on record as not being on board with, should check out this band, not to be all like, you like this, you stupid, listen to this instead. But I think that there's a lot of overlap with what people enjoy about those bands, but is a band that I highly recommend. Let's hear a little bit of The Lone Bellow.
Say
you can actually relive a lot of the Newport Folk Festival actually at the NPR Music website. If you go to nprmusic.org, we have much of it documented, and I highly recommend checking it out if you haven't already. And that brings us to the end of another episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at IDislikeStephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GHWeldon, WELDON. You can follow Kat Chow at KATCHOW. You can follow Gene Demby at GD215, GEEDEE215. You can follow our absent host, Linda Holmes, at NPR Monkey C. You can follow our absent panelist, Trey Graham, at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E. Graham like the cracker. You can follow our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. You can also follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Thank you all for being here this week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening, and we will see you here next week.